our time, yeah.
Money making while we're breaking, it's amazing. California celebrated or berated, it's been faded. California, Omaria, the hills are swarming with dead ends and the bots performing. Don't mistake it, you can break big till you get sick.
Those days, so baby, let me love.
Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers.
If you're talking, they will hear you.
We all want our kids to grow up safe and healthy. So we show them how. And we tell them with honest conversations that let them know what we expect. Not just one time, but every chance we get. That's especially important when it comes to alcohol and other drugs. Kids not only need to know the dangers and how to avoid them, they need to hear it often from you. And when it comes to pain medications, opioids, they need to know that they should never be taken without a prescription and never shared with friends or family. It's dangerous and illegal. So talk with your kids and guide them through the challenges of growing up safe and healthy. Because when you talk, they hear you. For more information about talking with your kids about underage use of alcohol and other drugs, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
So talk, they hear you. You can do it if you try.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, corporate news media have never been the right place to look for thoughtful, inclusive consideration of affirmative action. For them, it's mostly a quote-unquote issue, a political football, rather than a long effort to address the real, historical, and ongoing discrimination against non-white, non-male people in multiple aspects of U.S. life. But when it comes to the role that anti-discrimination, pro-equity efforts have had on Asian American communities, there are particular layers of mis- and disinformation that benefit from exploring. Listeners will know that Asian American students are being used right now as the face of attempts to eliminate affirmative action or race consciousness in college admissions. It looks like the Supreme Court will rule on a watershed case this month. We'll talk about it with writer and cultural critic Jeff Chang, author of We Gonna Be All Right, Notes on Race and Resegregation, among other titles. We'll also hear some of an earlier discussion of the case, Students for Fair Admissions, Inc. versus Harvard, that Counterspin had last fall with Jeannie Park, founding president of the Asian American Journalists Association in New York and a co-founder of the Coalition for a Diverse Harvard. That's coming up this week on Counterspin. After the Supreme Court failed to find that Abigail Fisher had been denied admission to the University of Texas due to racial discrimination against white people, anti-equity activist Ed Blum announced that he needed Asian plaintiffs to further the mission of eliminating affirmative action policies from college admissions. That's the short version and the basic context for the cases Blum's group, Students for Fair Admissions, Inc., is bringing against Harvard and the University of North Carolina, cases the Trump-stacked court will likely rule on in June. Affirmative action has always been a difficult topic for a press corps more comfortable talking about individual racists than systemic white supremacy, and worlds more happy to gesture towards buying the world a Coke than to unpack the particulars of what actually needs to happen to get to anything like equity or reparation for marginalized people. So these are things we should look out for in the coverage we may see on the court's possible upcoming ruling. Jeff Chang is a writer and cultural critic and author of most recently, We Gonna Be All Right, Notes on Race and Resegregation, And of course, 2005's Can't Stop, Won't Stop, A History of the Hip-Hop Generation. He was a co-founder of the Student Coalition for Fair Admissions, organized at UC Berkeley in 1987, and he joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Jeff Chang.
Thank you so much for having me, Janine.
Well, people may see that Asian Americans are being used here in this fight, and kind of used as a wedge between Black people and white people, and they may understand that stereotypes are being employed to advance an anti-equal opportunity argument. But I still think that folks might not understand the subversion or the distortion that this all represents of Asian Americans' historical role in the creation, in the beginning of affirmative action policies. And in your super useful April piece for The Guardian, you talk about this erased history. Would you fill us in on some of that missing history?
First of all, Asian Americans have been consistently polling in favor of affirmative action by really 2-1. And that's, I think, a fact that's often overlooked in media coverage of Asian Americans' perspectives on affirmative action. The history of affirmative action has Asian American influence all over it. If you look at the post-war period, the post-World War II period, and this rising period of civil rights, Japanese American civil rights leaders were working alongside African American leaders in arguing for equal opportunity and affirmative action. And they were doing it in the sort of context of looking at reparations, which was eventually granted the Japanese American community for what had been done to them in terms of incarcerating them during World War II. But all the way through the 1960s, what you see is steady and powerful advocacy on the part of Asian Americans to have them included in programs around equal opportunity. And what we begin to see in the universities is this bearing fruit in the 1970s and the 1980s. What you see, though, is by the 1980s, because of immigration, there's a much larger population of Asian American students who are applying for elite universities. And so at that time, universities begin to quietly and sometimes loudly take Asian Americans off of equal opportunity programs, despite the fact that there are a number of Asian American ethnicities, such as Filipino Americans and Southeast Asian Americans, who were still deeply underrepresented. And of course, Native Hawaiians and Pacific Islanders continue to be deeply underrepresented in college admissions and university admissions all across the U.S. So at that particular time, what we also see is a surge of applications from this new generation of immigrants. And universities are also experiencing concern from white alumni about the competition that these Asian American immigrants, this new generation, is sort of providing against their sons and daughters at elite universities, where in the past, legacy admissions have preserved their entitlement to slots at universities like Harvard, Yale, and Princeton. And so in the beginning of the 80s, what we begin to see is this sort of plateauing of the number of Asian Americans who are actually admitted to these universities. And community advocates in the Asian American community begin to get really concerned because the number of applications is still skyrocketing, but the number of admissions has plateaued. And so there's this huge gap that they want to explore. And when they do, especially at UC Berkeley, under the leadership of a group of community leaders there and a professor named Ling Chi Wong, they find that there have been a number of different types of changes that have been made in the admissions process that have actually discriminated against Asian Americans disproportionately and excluded them from admissions. And as studies pop up all across the country, at Brown University, at UCLA, at a number of other universities around the country, folks begin to find the same kinds of things happening.
Well, and then the idea that there could be anti-Asian American bias in college admissions, but that is not due to affirmative action policies. Here's where the conflation occurs and where the co-optation of the narrative occurs.
That's exactly right. What Asian Americans are arguing for at this particular point is a sense of fairness in what is supposed to be meritocratic competition between white and Asian students for these slots. Affirmative action is a completely different track, and students are judged for affirmative action by a different set of standards because of the importance of increasing diversity in these elite universities. That's what the Supreme Court has ruled over and over again. And really, actually, if we go back to it, affirmative action was begun as a remedy for historic discrimination. And so that's the way that I think a lot of communities of color are seeing the need for these affirmative action programs, despite the fact that before the court, the only justification for affirmative action programs now, because of the Bakke case in 1979, is this idea of diversity. Now, I'm getting to a lot of different types of things, but the main point here is to note that the Supreme Court, by getting rid of the historic discrimination standard for affirmative action programs, mm-hmm. has moved to this much lighter,
mushier,
much more sort of white-friendly idea of diversity. That is the main justification now before the law for these affirmative action programs to exist. But what happens with Asian Americans is you have Asian Americans here aiding diversity, right? And at the same time, you have white admissions officers, in order to please white alumni concerned about their children getting into these universities, tweaking the system so that Asian Americans are less competitive in comparison to white candidates in this supposedly pure meritocratic colorblind system.
Absolutely. And when I hear diversity as a goal, it sounds to me like a perk for white people, like sprinkles on the sundae. White people deserve to be on top, but to be surrounded by and quote unquote learn from the people they're on top of. You know, diversity is something that is a good thing. And this just leads directly to, and listeners may know this, but it doesn't appear particularly in a lot of media conversations. You hear Harvard's very competitive and Asian people and black and brown people are fighting for spots at Harvard. And it's like, those are the spots that are left over after we get through ALDC. And maybe you could explain what that is.
First, to go back, the main question becomes, who is diversity for?
Exactly.
And the diversity standard really was developed by Harvard as sort of an alternative justification for the equal opportunity programs that they were instituting in the 1960s and the 1970s as an alternative to recognizing that historically that they had excluded women, they'd excluded non-Protestant people, Catholics and Jewish people, and that this was really a way for them to preserve a sort of elite student body that they wanted to sculpt in their own image. And so we have to kind of go back to that. We have to mention that. We have to note that when we're talking about the programs that we're talking about now. Mm-hmm. And what they created at the same time was this notion of legacy admits, right? The technical term for it are ALDC admits. And this includes athletes, legacy admits, the dean's preferred list, children of faculty and staff. These are all preferential treatment slots that were given out even before equal opportunity programs had come into play in the 1960s. This is again to preserve, you know, privilege and wealth for a certain class of folks. And even now, when we look at white admissions to Harvard, 43% of them are non-competitive ALDC admits. And so the idea of preferential programs being just for black and brown students, for poor students, that's a recent development. Mm-hmm. Even now, right, we're talking about the large proportion of white students being admitted to Harvard via preferential treatment. And so now when we talk about what should these classes look like, and we have a case before the Supreme Court, which would basically make it impossible for elite universities to be able to bring in students who are not white, we have a situation in which we're solving a problem that just for elite universities, and in fact, inflicting that on the rest of society, and the results would be disastrous. Yeah. The results would be the resegregation of higher education. We'd be going back a century or more in time to a period in which campuses were less diverse than we could even imagine at this particular point.
Well, and not to put too fine a point on it, but I think when people hear about Ed Bloom and plaintiff shopping and knowing that, oh, on the other days of the week, he's opposing voting rights, he is obviously and his group are clearly not really concerned about equity across difference. But even besides that sort of consider the source argument, if this case wins in the court, it really doesn't mean anything extra good for Asian Americans. Like, it's not, you know, the people who are nominally the plaintiffs here, the cases themselves don't have anything in particular to do with Asian Americans in terms of their likely